Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Along with other countries around the world, the United States continues to debate, juggle, and deal with school closures and distance learning because of COVID-19. I don't think any of us expected to still be in this state at this time, but we are. It's here, and yes, we've got to deal with it, like it or not. While learning technology can carry a high cost economically and culturally, maybe a more important question is, how does it impact our kids' education and social skills? And today I'm joined by Justin Reich, who's going to talk about some of the issues and benefits of distance learning and technology. So let me tell you a little bit about my guest. He's the Mitsui Career Development Professor of Comparative Media Studies and Director of the Teaching Systems Lab at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He hosts the podcast Teach Lab and has written about education and technology for Education Week, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and Science. He has a brand new book out addressing this subject in depth. It's called Failure to Disrupt: Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. And here's my guest, Justin Reich. Well, Justin Reich, welcome to the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, there's such a lot to discuss, and the book is very timely, so let's dive right into this. You say that your goal as a leader in educational technology and with your book, Failure to Disrupt, is to separate fact from fiction around what tech can do and can't do to transform our classrooms. So let's begin with why you wanted to write this and who you had in mind as you wrote Failure to Disrupt.
Well, I observed over the last 10 years that there has just been, you know, a very powerful rhetoric that new technologies have the power to transform education systems. So there was a Harvard Business School professor, Clay Christensen, in 2009, who said that by 2019, half of all 6 through 12 classes would be offered in online or blended format, that they would cost a third as much to provision, and they would be better than existing classes. When massive open online courses, these giant university-level courses, started being offered in 2012 and 2013, there was an entrepreneur, Sebastian Thrun, who said that in 50 years, there's only going to be 10 institutions of higher education left, and one of these new massive open online course providers might be one of them. And those predictions sort of rubbed against the way that I understood education systems, which they're in many respects quite conservative. They have a wide variety of expectations placed upon them, and the people within them, I think do the best they can to negotiate all of those competing claims. And historically, there have been lots of instances of saying, you know, radio is going to transform education, film strips are going to transform right. education. So I wanted to look back over the history, particularly the last 30 years, and say, what have we seen computers, the internet, online tools actually do in schools and colleges, and what could we expect in the future?
Right. Now, obviously, you wrote the book pre-pandemic. It's just been released, and you do address that in the introduction. You say that hopefully by the time we get the books in our hands, things will have changed. Well, they have not, obviously. But in many ways, now is the perfect time to bring this out. Wouldn't you agree?
Sure. I think it helps people understand why these remarkable claims about the transformative power of technology haven't come true. One of the things that I describe in the prologue of the book is in the middle of March, there were some schools around Seattle that closed, and a Seattle reporter interviewed a Seattle area parent, and the parent was saying, well, our school went to fully online learning, but I got to tell you, my 7-year-old just can't participate in virtual school all day without me being there helping them all the time. And that article really struck me because I thought to myself, of course a 7-year-old can't be handed an iPad and told to participate in remote schooling all day long. You know, when you stop to think about it for a minute, it's kind of preposterous to think that a young child would have that kind of self-control and executive function and all of these other things. But I presume that parent's a smart person, and the journalist is a smart person, and the teacher is, and the principal is. How could we get ourselves in the society thinking that technology would have such kind of magical, profound capacities, except for the fact that over the last 10 or 20 years, people have been saying just that, that we're on the precipice of these grand changes, and there may be some folks who would have thought that the pandemic would prove, you know, to be the time that new technologies finally arrive. I'm on panels and discussions all the time that are called the dawn of online learning, reimagining higher education. But the fact is that I think most students and most families feel somewhat disappointed with the technology options and the online learning options that are available to them. Because there's certain kinds of things that they can do really well, and will certainly have a role in the future of our education systems. But I think we're learning just how powerful and important traditional classroom instruction is.
Right. You know, many people would argue we just weren't ready for it. But I've done a lot of online learning, and I cannot imagine expecting a 6 or 7 year old to sit there all day and, you know, as you said, follow instruction on an iPad. It's just not going to happen. So I want to look at some of the promises made. You touched on them briefly. I want to just look a little bit more in detail. One of the things you talk about is massive open online courses, which apparently the New York Times in 2012 said this was going to be the great new thing. It turns out not so much. You talk about auto graders, you talk about computerized intelligent tutors, which I assume are kind of like robot teachers, but the list goes on. What do you think, you know, when we're talking about this and the proponents are pushing this, what are they hyping the most, and what has the least feedback? What has the least payback?
Well, I think there are two big mistakes in the kinds of claims that education technologists make. One is that education technologies can be sweepingly transformative. I haven't quite found the right metaphor, but sometimes they talk about them like Swiss Army knives that can do everything. Sometimes right. They talk about bulldozers that sort of sweep away the present, make room for a new future. But in fact, our education technology tools are very specific. They're more like specific pegs for particularly shaped holes. So there are technology tools that definitely improve learning experiences for people of all different kinds of ages, but they tend to not be things that, you know, sweep away the need for existing schools. They more to be like, oh, that would be a good tool for introductory learning language for certain parts of that study, or that's a good tool for learning some parts of computer programming, but not other parts. So it's better to understand new education technologies as specific, as useful for particular people in particular contexts and particular subjects, and not sweeping. And the second big mistake I think they make is to describe technologies like they can be turned on and off like a switch. Like if we just hand out these tools or download this app, then everyone will be able to use them and teaching and learning will be different. But we've known since the 1980s that that's not the case. In the 1980s, Judith Sandholz led a project called the Apple Classrooms of Tomorrow, where she got these Apple IIe computers and put them in classrooms with wired networks between them. You know, it was very, very cutting edge in the 1980s. And she found that most teachers, when they got all of these new tools, used them to extend existing practices, to do the kinds of things they were doing before a little bit more efficiently. And it was only after a long time of practice and professional development and collaborative planning that people come up with new innovative things to do with technologies. And that's as true today as it was then. What we're witnessing around the world right now is millions and millions of educators thrust into these new forms of online and hybrid learning and trying to figure out how to make them work. And they can't do it instantaneously because using new technologies effectively takes time, takes practice, takes planning, takes collaborative feedback. It's a learning process, not a switch that you flip on or off.
Right. I think also we need to consider the fact that driving this, the proponents mostly are Silicon Valley companies, tech companies, entrepreneurs who are trying to sell their latest product. And that's a big factor because we've been sold a lot of software along the years. It just is not effective on any level. And when you're talking about changing a system, you know, traditional schooling system, I mean, that's very critical, I think.
I also think technologists tend tend to understand technology better than they understand social human systems. Mm-hmm. And so they think to themselves, like, oh, here's an inefficiency that I detect. Therefore, this new technology can sort of plow through that inefficiency. But there's lots of inefficiencies in our learning systems that are desirable. You could describe, the first few minutes of class where kids are wandering into the classroom and just sort of saying hello to each other, and the teacher's kind of checking in, and you could look at that and say, wow, that could really be streamlined. But one of the things that we're learning this year is that those brief social moments are essential. They are essential to the relationships that form the foundation of schooling. And so things that from, one perspective can look simple or inefficient can actually prove to be quite nuanced, quite important parts of education systems.
Right. I'd like to talk, Justin, about what you call the trap of technologies like autograders. Autograders are sent up, obviously, to be auto-responsive. And I see a lot of issues in that. What do you see from your perspective?
So in the book, I describe this idea of the trap of routine assessment, which is that we want to develop learning technologies that individuals can participate in on their own and on their own pace. Learning requires feedback. And so if there's not a human there to give feedback with a nod or with a check plus or with a grade or with a smile or a gold star, then we need to program computers to be able to do that. Well, as it turns out, we've been working on this for 60 years. We've been working on computer assessment of human performance for as long as we've had computers the size of your living room. And we've made marginal progress during that time. Computers are good at evaluating human performance when that human performance is very structured and routine, when there's only one right answer to a question, or when there's a range of right answers that can be computed, like if you were to create a simulator for an electrical circuit. And there's a few other kind of interesting things. It turns out we built some pretty good tools to evaluate pronunciation. We can build language learning apps that can detect whether or not you've said por favor correctly. But generally speaking, the kinds of assessments that we can build are the kinds of things that computers are already good at doing. And we don't really need human beings to do the kinds of things that humans are good at doing. We need humans to do the kinds of things that computers are bad at, and that we need to do in the civic sphere and the labor market. One of the main things that we teach in all forms of education is reasoning from evidence, and reasoning from evidence in natural speech and in writing. And it turns out our computational graders for these kinds of things are actually not very effective at all, despite, vast amounts of investment and very smart people working on this problem for a long period of time. This trap means that, computers are good at assessing the kinds of things computers are already good at, and that we don't need human beings to do anymore. And the more that we build learning systems around this limited suite of technology, the more that, in a sense, we're sort of steering our education systems away from maybe the most important things that there are for humans to learn.
Yeah. One of the things that concerns me, some time ago I did a show with somebody who'd worked in Silicon Valley for many years, and she'd written a book about Silicon Valley, the sexism there, and why algorithms are sexist, which at first I thought, okay, that sounds really odd. But as she explained, most of those algorithms are written by, the typical Silicon Valley nerd, and typically they tend to be young guys. So that's where she was coming from there. Do you see something like that as a problem?
Oh, and it's a very immediate and urgent problem. So one of the technologies that has grown most rapidly during the pandemic is exam proctoring software, software that allows a combination of artificially intelligent agents and, poorly paid humans to surveil the behavior of test takers while they're taking tests. And it does this basically by sort of hijacking the systems on your computer. It's kind of a descendant from malware, and students, by and large, hate it, but they're required to use it by the universities. There's a lot of controversy with this with bar exams right now, but the automated tools, the cameras don't necessarily always detect black faces correctly. They don't detect dark-skinned people with beards. There was a case recently of a woman who had a tic as a developmental condition, and she had never before described her tic as a learning disability, but she started to realize that these exam proctors doctors were going to flag her for potential cheating efforts because her face moves differently than other people's faces do. And these are non-trivial considerations. These are test takers who, you know, are marginalized in society in some kind of way, and now there's a whole bunch of additional work that they have to do to light themselves differently, to register their tick as a disability so they can get, you know, the proper exceptions for it and so forth, you know, while they're just trying to take a test and be like the rest of us. And so, you know, I think this, you know, there was another case, actually, where in the UK they weren't able to do a series of examinations that they usually do, and so they used a kind of machine learning model to predict what people's grades would have been and then assign them those grades. But one of the things they put into the machine learning model was the previous grades that people at your school had earned. So if you were at a school that was lower resourced and had, you know, historically produced people that had gotten lower grades, then that was one of the factors that went into your grade. And of course, that's preposterous. Like, we don't believe that people's grades should be determined by who they happen to have previously, you know, by the people who had previously gone to their school. So, you know, in the midst of the pandemic right now, we're seeing some very troubling applications of machine learning and artificial intelligence in education, which goes right to the heart of what you said, which is that these tools can be designed in ways that are discriminatory.
Right, right. Very interesting. A lot, so many factors to take into consideration. But you do say there is a place where technology does play a crucial role in the future of education. So how do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's maybe a bit unusual about me is that I'm an education technology critic, but I'm also a person who builds a bunch of education technologies.
There you go.
I think the key is to say, look, if we can recognize, especially looking historically, that these are tools that serve particular people for particular learning objectives and particular subjects, and that they don't work on their own, they only work when you build alongside the technology a community of people who's thinking about how to change other kinds of educational practices so that these technologies can make a difference, then there's plenty of room for improvement along those lines. We have lots of technologies that help in particular circumstances. One fortunate thing that's happened, a fortunate occurrence during the pandemic is that over the last 10 years, there are a bunch of folks who have worked on kind of like gamified adaptive math platforms for really young learners. As I said before, math is one of these areas in which, you know, for things like computation, we have pretty good auto graders. There are, you know, approaches to including game mechanics to make these things kind of fun and playful. And it turns out that teaching elementary mathematics through video conferencing is really hard. It's really hard to introduce students to these ideas if you can't look over their shoulder and put manipulatives in their hands. But it turns out that we have a bunch of tools for independent K-5 math learning that are kind of fun and kind of work. And so the idea is not to say, well, okay, now let's completely rearrange mathematics teaching around these new kinds of tools. It's to say, no. There's a time and a place for each of these things, and they will incrementally, over time, help improve our education systems. And for folks who are hoping for disruptive, transformative changes in education, that's probably disappointment. But if you see human development as a long, slow, iterative, recursive process with two steps back for every three steps forward, then these kinds of modest incremental advances are as good as it gets.
Right, right. You say that, you know, don't look for the next killer app. That's not what is going to reform efforts. But we need to focus support for communities of educators. So what does that support look like? Because I know so many educators were like, you know, thrown in at the deep end on this because of the pandemic.
Yes, I think it's appalling the unbelievably little support that as states and federal government we've provided to teachers. Even if the pandemic had, you know, mysteriously disappeared on August 31st, you still would have had 57 million students coming into schools, many of whom had missed months of school, had experienced being homes with evictions and job losses and all these kinds of things. One of the strange features of the American school system is that we ask our teachers to be directly teaching students much more so than other similarly advanced countries. In other advanced countries, teachers have more time in their working day for collaborative planning, for grading, for giving feedback, and so forth. The way that you create that additional time is that you hire more teachers. You invest more in the next generation so that they can help build a society that we can all retire in. And there's no sort of magic way of getting around that additional time. Now, in my work at the MIT Teaching Systems Lab, we do think that online learning is one potential way of supporting teacher learning. Teachers lead complex lives, and so we do want to be able to provide them with different kinds of on-demand learning experiences or asynchronous learning experiences that they can sort of fit into their complex schedules. But there's really no substitute for making sure that teachers as a profession have the time that it takes to learn and grow and develop and get better at teaching with each other and teaching our children.
Yeah, I'm sure you've heard this comment many times, Justin, that, you know, I have friends who are educators at various levels, you know, from young kids through, you know, PhD programs. But and the thing I've heard is, you know, I went into education to educate, and I seem to spend half my time fixing problems with tech now. But I think that's the nature of the workforce in general now. You know, I'm a writer, I'm a communication strategist, and I've spent days sometimes on tech problems. How do you get them to make that switch in their head?
The switch in their head?
That this is the way they need to, that I'm an educator and I shouldn't have to be involved in this in tech. Because there are people out there who feel that way. I've run into doctors as well
and I've run into a lot of them as well. And I've come over because I used to run a consultancy which went to schools and helped them figure out how to integrate technologies in thoughtful ways. And originally I thought of these resistors as people who were Luddites or afraid of the future. Increasingly I've come to understand them as folks who've said, I've invested a lot of time in my craft as a teacher, and I see these new technologies coming in and not really making a big difference and, you know, taking away my time for these technology-mediated activities when I should just be spending my time focused on what students are doing. I think it's, you know, for me, it's really hard to imagine a robust 13-year education in the public school system that doesn't have students leave well prepared to use technologies in a variety of ways for academic work, for research, for creative expression. But I do often think, boy, if there are a bunch of teachers who have really developed a traditional craft, is it the best use of their time and energy to make them learn new things, or should we figure out other ways in the education system? You know, I used to be a history teacher, and I've often thought, well, you know, we have a pretty typical history sequence. What if we asked some group of teachers to really focus on traditional practices in our ninth grade world history class, and then the people who are really excited about more technology-mediated things, we do more of that in our 10th grade U.S. history class, and then people have a sort of coherent experience as they move through a departmental program. So I think there's a lot of wisdom to be cultivated and maintained and honored in the people who are somewhat resistant to these changes in practice, especially if they really have something compelling from a well-honed traditional practice to offer.
Right. I want to talk about the social benefits of school, because this is, again, one of the things that I've heard frequently from people, is that the kids aren't getting the social aspects of school. And I mean, we're talking there about, you know, I think that's where, you know, I learn teamwork there. You learn collaboration, friendship, you do sports, and the list goes on. We've heard from people like Betsy DeVos that many kids rely on school for food and nutrition and shelter. That raises a whole other conversation. But how do we compensate with those missing social benefits? It's not the same online.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, one thing that I've said to a bunch of folks is that everyone is having a different pandemic. So there are a minority of students that I think have discovered that online learning is great, that they found that school produced all kinds of social anxieties for students who are from minoritized backgrounds. You know, they may have experienced school as a place where they found racism and bigotry, and now they're learning that they can just stay at home in the loving arms of their families, and this is better. So, you know, everyone's having a different experience. For some people, the social aspects of school are stressful or harmful. And then for lots and lots of students, they're the reason to go. I've done a bunch of work over the course of the summer, talking with teachers, talking with students, talking with other school stakeholders. And a big part of those discussions was saying, okay, we can't do the social aspects of school as well as me when I want to or perfectly online, but what can we do? And in our conversations with students and teachers, we find that with some deliberateness, we can create social environments online. I hope that there are a bunch more schools this semester that are experimenting with video game esports instead of sports. Like, we can still do teamwork and playing and competing. And if it's unsafe to do football and wrestling, then, you know, let them play Overwatch and Fortnite. And there are other kinds of practices that we have in schools that if we think about them and are creative, we can figure out other ways to meet them. One of my favorite conversations with a group of students was one where a student said, I wish there was just a button that I could press and a teacher would show up and help me in my online schooling. And it got me thinking, one of the things that is underappreciated but pretty incredible about schools is that if you're a young person, you can raise your hand almost anywhere on a school campus, and in a minute or two, a caring adult will come and help you. You can do it in the cafeteria, you can do it in the classroom, you can do it in the library, you can do it in the study hall. And so a bunch of schools have started thinking and brainstorming, all right, what would it look like to provide that kind of real-time help? We ended up calling it a call a teacher button. Would it be a browser plug-in that connected you to a classroom, a virtual meeting that was always staffed by someone, or a sort of text messaging hotline that went to the dean on duty? But I think if we're deliberate about asking students, you know, what their needs are, what kind of socializing they're hoping to have, we can be creative even during these difficult periods about making those kinds of opportunities possible. If not perfectly, then, you know, in first prototype kinds of steps.
Yeah. So as we stand today, we're almost at the end of our segment here, but I want to get this in, Justin. As we stand today, what do you find most alarming or disturbing and most promising about tech in education?
Well, the most alarming things about technology in education have to do with the degree to which we are increasingly surveilling our students. My colleague Chris Gilliard at Macomb Community College says, you know, one of the things we do in schools is we watch, and we are watched. That's a big part of learning. But I don't think we want young people growing up believing that it's normal for adults to be tracking their every move, their every action, their every click, their every time they turn on and off their video camera. I think we need to be very thoughtful about the kinds of data that we collect, not only because of risks to privacy and those kinds of things, but because of the risks of basically inculcating young people, socializing young people into a surveillance culture. The things that make me most excited about technology are all of the creative ways that students and teachers are coming together to explore what new forms of good teaching practice might look like. There's all kinds of discussion, for instance, of learning loss. You know, what is it that students missed over this spring or this past summer? How far behind are they? I think there's some important considerations there. But I think we also have to pause and think about what are all the things that students have learned over the last 9 months that they wouldn't have learned otherwise, and how do we celebrate that growth and resilience? I think there are a lot of students who have developed new fluencies with technology, new proficiencies with independent self-directed learning. And as much as we should be concerned about losses and things that are missing, we should celebrate the resilience of young people during the pandemic.
Yeah, I agree. That's a lovely note to end the show on. I've seen some extraordinary creativity come from parents and teachers and students themselves to make this as appetizing as possible for everyone. So the book is called Failure to Disrupt: Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. Is there a website for the book? I know it's put out by Harvard Press and they have a link there, but do you have an
actual... You can also go to failuretodisrupt.com, and there are reviews and links and other things, and there's a virtual book club we're doing where we have guests discussing each chapter of the book with me running through November, and then it'll all be available on demand online afterwards.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Thank you, Justin Reich. Thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate your time and your expertise. And just a quick word to listeners. I want to thank you all for joining us today. Questions, comments, or feedback on today's show, you can reach me through our website at conversationslive.net. And you'll find more than 700 podcasts, over 1,200 guest interviews there too, conversationslive.net. Until next week, stay healthy and live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.